Thanks, everybody, for taking the time out of your busy schedules today. I know it's a really hectic time at this time of the year before we finish up for 2016, but we're really excited today to be presenting this in partnership with Microsoft BizSpark, the Ask Me Anything webinar, where we're going to answer a number of legal questions that have come through. So we opened this up about 3-4 weeks ago, and essentially the what we're trying to do here is, at LawPath, we get hundreds of questions a week from, you know, startups of all different shapes and sizes and from business owners as well. And they're really specific questions around different areas of their business, what they can do to make sure that they've got the right kind of legal protection, and then just really questions about how to set things up, how to make sure that you've got all the right contracts in place and what to do moving forward. And we thought, what a better time of the year to answer any of these burning questions that you have at the end of the year, get all these questions off your chest, be able to provide some really great answers to these so that you can move forward in 2017 with a clean slate. And to kick things off, I'm going to pass you over to the presenter today, who is Dominic Woolrich. He's the head of legal here at LawPath. He'll be able to take you through a little bit of the agenda that we're running through for today and be able to kick things off. So I'll pass you over to Dom now.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Look, I think, as Tom just mentioned, it's really great that we've had the opportunity to do this Ask Me Anything, because we get a lot of questions, and often they're the same questions from different startups over and over again. And so here's hoping today we can get some out for you and recorded, so moving forward, everybody can come back to the recordings and listen to questions that might be asked or might be really affecting the way that you run your business. So what I'll do is, we've only got about 40 minutes today, and as Tom mentioned, we have a lot of questions to get through. We have prioritized the most important ones. That's not to say if you did ask a question and you're out there listening and we don't get to it, we're very, very happy to answer your question, but maybe it won't make it into this 40-minute time slot. We can follow up with the answers with you. You're more than welcome to contact us via our chat or our phone lines, and we're happy to answer them. So just to start off, guys, I'd love to give you a little bit of a background about LawPath. I know a lot of you are already existing customers of ours, but for the new ones out there, LawPath is an online legal services business. We started about 2.5 years ago. We're a startup, just like a lot of you are, and really we started the business to help out other businesses with their legal needs. Often at the beginning, it's very, very daunting, and it's very, very expensive to set up your company, especially in the legal space. And so we wanted to build technology and build services that meant that you could do that much cheaper and far more efficiently. So in the last 2.5 years, we've grown very, very quickly. We've up now to about 650 lawyers. So we have a law network all over Australia that provide services through LawPath. And it's very easy for you to engage those lawyers through our website. We're also up to about 28,000 clients or users. So that's users that come through and use our documents, use our guides, or engage with our lawyers. And the great thing is we estimate that over the last 2 years, we've saved about $6 million in legal fees. So really, really good result. And he's hoping we keep growing and we can keep helping Australian small businesses. Now, as Tom mentioned, this Ask Me Anything today is in partnership with Microsoft BizSpark. And so, Esther, if you're still there, I might hand it over to you to give a little bit of a rundown about Microsoft BizSpark.
Great. Thanks, Dom. So, so my name's Esther. I run the BizSpark program in Australia. The BizSpark program is Microsoft's way of supporting startups through free software services and visibility. So in terms of software, we give startups access to around $16,000 worth of software. That's ranging from Windows to Office to Visual Studio for developers. We also give you guys $200 a month free credits of Azure Cloud Services. So whether you want to use that on website hosting, data storage, virtual machines, we leave it up to you really. In terms of visibility as well, we're more than happy to help startups connect to customers and get them out into the media, etc. It is a one-year program and it's super easy to join. It's just an online application at bizspark.microsoft.com. I'll be on the call later on as well. If you guys do have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. Thanks, Tom.
Fantastic. Thanks, Esther. So look, let's keep it off today, guys. Very, very quickly, a little bit about myself, just so you know that you're talking to someone with a little bit of authority. I am a solicitor. I've worked in big corporate law. I've worked in criminal law. I've also worked in international law. But as I mentioned, for the last 2.5 years, I've really just specialized in startups and small businesses, and day to day answering question after question about how to get your business off and running, and more importantly, how you can protect yourself legally for the lowest cost possible. And that's what I really want to try and do today in answering these questions, is obviously give you the right answers, but also give you the tools or point you in the right direction to to be able to complete these things cost effectively. Because let's be honest, at the end of the day, we're all small businesses, we don't have that much money, we need to make sure we get legally protected for the lowest cost possible. So today we've broken our questions down into 7 categories. I hope to spend about 5 minutes on each category, and we'll run through those. I've broken them into areas of law, so I think that I think it'll be very useful to kind of group the questions together, because it'll give you a better insight into the area of law that we're talking about at that moment. So how we're going to run today is actually Tom here, he's going to join me. He's actually going to ask the questions, and then I'll give you the responses. So let's kick it off.
Fantastic. So the first question we received was from Emma. Emma's question was, I have just set up a company with a business partner, and we have some further opportunities to partner both here and internationally. What do we need to be aware of?
Fantastic. Well done, Emma. Congratulations on starting your new company, and it sounds like there's some international opportunities there. It's going to be a big 2017 for you. So I think the first thing to be aware of, Emma, is obviously the structure that you set up with. So you started with a company, but there's obviously two of you there. And I think what is really, really important when there's two shareholders in a company is that you have a shareholders agreement. Now, this is a document that governs how you two, as partners in the company, interact with each other and interact with the company. Now, I can't tell you how many times that companies have started and the two founders, they just register the company with ASIC, which is the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, and they don't have any kind of documentation in place to see how they're going. The problem is, down the track, if there's ever any kind of dispute, or somebody else wants to come into the company or purchase shares, or somebody wants to leave the company, for example, they have a baby and they can't work with the company anymore, it's so important that you have a document in place that talks about how you would deal with these situations. And that document is a shareholders agreement. Now, there's two ways to go about getting a shareholders agreement. The first would be that you can go on the LawPath website, you can do a DIY version. It's completely free. You can answer some questions, and the software will create a shareholders agreement for you. If you are looking to go a little bit more in depth and a little bit more complex, it might be an idea to engage a lawyer. So Emma, lastly, if you are looking to go international, I think one of the main considerations would be around tax and where you're actually earning that revenue. So if you're performing the services or selling the goods here in Australia, an Australian company will be sufficient. But if you are starting to perform those services or sell those goods or services overseas, then you might be looking to actually start a company in the other jurisdiction as well, especially for tax purposes that can be very beneficial. So I think the first thing is make sure all the documentation between you and your partner is correct. And lastly, if you are going overseas and you are starting to earn the majority of your revenue overseas, then you'll need to look at starting an international company. Last thing to touch on, Emma, is if there are contracts that need to be drawn up between you and the international company, such as a services agreement or a contractors agreement, very, very important that you get that in writing. It's not sufficient to just have email chains. You must have it in writing. All right, we'll move on to the next question.
So the next question came from Robert. And so Robert's question was, I am thinking of being the nominee of a PTYT, Proprietary Limited Plumbing Company, for an old friend, but I want him to sign an agreement that any financial costs from work performed will be borne totally from the company. Will this protect me legally from any debts or costs created by the company? If not, then how would I protect myself?
Right. Well, Robert, I think it's fantastic that you asked this question because this is a very, very, you need to be very cautious in this area. And the actual response to this one is if you are a nominee director in the company, you are then treated as a director in the company and therefore must follow the fiduciary duties and obligations of a director. So if you were to act negligently and the company was to go into any kind of debts, you would be responsible. There is no way of contracting out of those responsibilities. So for example, you must act in the best interests of the company. You must act with no improper purpose. You must take care, due care and diligence, and you must be discreet and confidential with respect to the company. To sum it up, your obligations are actually to the company and not to your friend that wants you to be the nominee. So be very, very cautious in this situation. If you are to be a nominee, you need to understand that your duties will be exactly the same as if you were a director in the company. Robert, this area can get quite complex. So I'm more than happy to speak further with you on the phone to discuss the intricacies of the deal that you're looking to set up.
Great. So the next question that we've got that came from Sasha. So Sasha has been continuously working on getting corporate sponsors to support arts and entertainment business. Getting support for arts and cultural events in Australia is a massive challenge. I've recently set up another business in the building industry in order to try a new model. I'd like the building business to sponsor the arts business, such as buy advertising space during the arts events, promotion, etc. At present, it is experimental, but seems to be working. Do you see any problems, and I guess more from a legal perspective, Dom, with this model?
Sure. Thanks, Sasha. So look, well done on the new business. I think one thing to note, it's quite a simple answer, and that is that from a legal side of things, on face value of your question, there is no issue with it. However, I think it's going to be very important that you have full disclosure on both sides. So on the building construction business side, you need to give full disclosure that you are sponsoring this art and crafts movement that you have and that you have a vested interest in that. And on the arts and crafts side, there needs to be full disclosure that the company that is sponsoring is owned by you. So as I said, on face value of your question, I don't see any legal issues as long as there is openness around the full relationship. If there are any further details that were left out of the question, that's when legal issues could arise.
Great. That sounds pretty encouraging for Sasha there. Fantastic. We'll move on to the next question, which has come through from Sarah. And a simple one here about R&D research and development, Dom. How does the R&D tax incentive work?
Sure. Good question, Sarah. And everybody out there should be thinking about this R&D tax incentive because it is really the lifeblood for startups and small businesses in Australia. The fantastic thing, if you're not aware of the R&D tax incentive, is that the government will actually rebate you up to 43 cents on the dollar for R&D activities. So if you're a small business and you have spent more than $20,000 on R&D activities in a tax financial year, the following year you can actually be rebated almost half of that money. So I think it's really, really important for you to have a look at this. Sarah, in a little bit more detail, what you need to be across. You must register for R&D tax incentives. So you need to register yourself with Oz Industry. You can do that for up to 10 months after the end of the financial year. Once you're registered, you need to double check that you're eligible for R&D. And to be eligible, you need to be an Australian company or an Australian resident for tax purposes. And then the third is that you need to meet this threshold of $20,000. And that needs to be on R&D. Now, one trap for young players that we see here a lot at Lawpath is people trying to do their R&D claims by themselves. It's really, really important that you get an accountant to look after this for you. There is a whole network of accountants out there that specialize in R&D tax incentives. They usually take between 10 and 20% of the, sorry guys, bit of a croaky throat today. They usually take between 10 and 20% of the claim, but it is definitely worthwhile because they will go through and they'll really be able to maximize your rebate. So definitely recommend reaching out to an R&D tax incentive specialist at the end of the financial year or even pre-end of financial year, because there are certain ways and certain tricks that you can record your revenue throughout the year for R&D purposes that will allow you to maximize your rebate at the end of the year. So yeah, definitely recommend looking into that. If you haven't looked at yet, any businesses out there, please go and look at the R&D tax incentive from Oz Industry, because as I said, 43 cents back for every dollar you spend is a lot of money for a small business.
Awesome. Okay, we'll move on to the next question, which again is in business structure. This one comes from Tamara, and this again relates, Dom, around business partnerships. So Tamara said that she's ended a business partnership in July. Our partners are not agreeing with how everything gets split. The partners currently have hold or spent $6,000 as well as a van, which was paid by the company. There is other money on hold in the business. I believe $6,000 has been spent on starting a new business. What can I do? So this is a pretty kind of common line of questioning that we get at Lawpath around partnerships and their disputes with partners.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate place to be, Tamara, but look, you're not alone. This happens a lot of the time. And it kind of goes back to my comment right at the beginning there, talking about having agreements in place that actually stipulate what happens if something falls apart. So we get startups, new businesses coming to us all the time that say, look, unfortunately, it just didn't work out, and what can we do? So I think the first thing to note would be, if you're in a business, in your question there, you talk about business partnership, but then you also mention company. So I think it's really important to strike the difference between a partnership structure and a company structure. As a partnership, there is limited liability there, and you are effectively two sole traders working together. As a company, you're actually a separate legal entity. So depending on what the structure is, will actually depend on the different way that you sort this out. Now I'm going to move forward with the most common, which would be that you are a company structure. And if you have a shareholders agreement, in that shareholders agreement, it will stipulate how you deal with these disputes. However, if you don't have a shareholders agreement, there are a number of things that you can do. And the three most common ones are, you can go to court and you can run a case for oppressive conduct under the Corporations Act, which will allow you to have the court decide how the company is broken up and how that $6,000 needs to be reimbursed. There are two other applications you can make under the Corporations Act around directors' duties as well. However, at the end of the day, to be honest, Tamara, in this situation, it's going to come down to a commercial decision. I know you're in a really tough spot, but $6,000 to go to court, it may cost you $4,000 or $5,000 to start the proceedings. So it's going to be really, really important to weigh up whether going down this litigation route is the way to go, or is there any way that you can negotiate out of this predicament that you're in. So I suppose recapping, so important to have a shareholders agreement, because then it's just written there actually how it works. But if you don't, you do have to end up going to court, which can get expensive. So tough spot to be in, bit of a rock and a hard place, to be honest. I think that you need to have a real think about, is there any way without starting litigation we can resolve this $6,000 issue?
Well said. I will move on to the next question, which is, we've started now in the route of online business, which is a massive area of business for Lawpath. We do countless numbers of privacy policies, terms and conditions each month. And the first question that we have here is in relation to terms and conditions, Dom. So I have an organizing business and my website has terms and conditions. Do I need a separate privacy policy? I notice many other small businesses have them on their websites. Also, do I need to add anything further if I sell products online, my own or from a third party? That's from Nicola.
Great, Nicola, good question. Yes, you do need a separate privacy policy. If you go on a lot of these websites, you go down to the bottom of the page and you'll see there they have terms and conditions and a separate document that is a privacy policy. Now, the reason that you need a privacy policy is that you're collecting personal information or what's known as confidential information. So this could be first or last names, email addresses, or even if you are selling online, credit card information. So it is really, really important that you have a document on your website that talks about how you collect that information, how you use that information, and where you might be sharing that information. So step one, you'll need a separate privacy policy. Fantastic thing is, Lawpath website, you can get a free one. It takes you about 5 minutes to complete, and you'll have it all ready to go to get up onto your website. Now, the second part of your question around if you're selling a product online, and they're yours or a third party's, this is going to be contained in your website terms and conditions. So if you are selling goods and services online, you are required by law to have website terms and conditions on your website. And this will deal with things, most importantly, refunds and returns. Now, if you've got a third party and you're selling third party products, within your T's and C's, you will most likely have a limitation of liability waiver that talks about that you didn't create the products and may allow for the liability to pass through you to the manufacturer of the products. So to recap, you're going to need a privacy policy and terms and conditions. And if you are selling third-party goods and services on your website, you'll probably need terms and conditions that are slightly modified to accommodate those.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's all the privacy policies. It's something that we get a lot of questions about. And it's something that a lot of businesses, I think, because by the legal definition, they don't think it's mandatory to have. But if not for anything else, it adds such a trust from a consumer perspective as well. You know, the government recently did a study on where people were reading privacy policies, and they found that almost 50%, I think it was 45% of consumers are actually reading the privacy policies now of sites before actually going through to purchase. And so this just gives you a further way of being able to, you know, make sure and put the trust in the consumer's mind that they're buying from a, you know, a legitimate party and that they've got the trust from both sides. We'll move on to the next question, which is from Sin. And Sin's question relates to being a solo entrepreneur or a solopreneur. And what is it that needs to be in the following statements? And some of this might have already been covered in the previous questions, but or particularly from, I guess, a solo entrepreneur, making sure they've got everything covered around a privacy statement and the terms and conditions. I think essentially what needs to be included in those two documents.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, this follows on really nicely from the previous question. So let's delve a little bit deeper into what actually needs to be in these documents. So the privacy statement, as I mentioned, or the privacy policy, is going to talk about how you collect, store, and use this information. But what is really interesting is in 2014, the government actually changed the legislation around privacy policies and made it mandatory that when within your privacy policy, you must actually stipulate what countries the information might be shared in. Now, you might be thinking, I'm just an Australian business, I'm not sharing this kind of information anywhere. However, it's really important to remember that on your servers or where your website is hosted, it actually might be overseas. So if you're collecting email addresses, full names, dates of birth, that information, although your website is located in Australia, the servers might be overseas, and you need to put in your privacy policy where those actually list where those countries are. So you'll see in a lot of privacy policies that it will say your information might be stored in Australia, China, America, but that's actually a legal requirement. Now on to terms and conditions. If you're selling goods and services, as I mentioned, you need terms and conditions, specifically the returns and the refund policy information. Under the Australian consumer law, you're required to have this in there. But if you're not selling goods and services, you're only going to need a terms of use. And this is a terms of use about your website. So that this might be a blog or an information website. And this document will talk about how people can use your website, the information and the pictures on the website, how they can't copy them and take them somewhere else. So no matter what kind of website you have, you are going to require at least one type of legal document for it.
Great. Thanks for the question, Sin. We'll move on. Here comes one from Sheila. She wants to know if she can use the information that is available online, things like names and address details, from a directory operated by another business. I want to create my own directory. Can I gather the information from these sources and utilize on my own website without breaking the law? They are professional profiles of people. This is actually, again, quite a common question that we get.
Yeah, and Sheila, look, it's going to come down to the terms of use of that website. So what you'll see, for example, LinkedIn, part of their terms of use is that they don't allow you to take the information off there and use it for commercial purposes. You can see the reasoning behind that. They spend a lot of time building up this network and these profiles, and they don't want people to come along and just, the term is, scrape all of the profiles and use them on a website for commercial purposes. So they may allow you under their terms and conditions to use them for educational or other purposes, but for commercial purposes, if that's what your website is looking to do, under the terms and conditions, it'll most likely restrict it. So what I would definitely recommend is that you look at the terms and conditions on the website that you're looking to scrape, and have a look as to whether they allow that kind of activity. But unfortunately, Sheila, in most cases, they don't.
Fantastic. I think this is a good point to raise from the flip side of this as well, on the importance, Dom, of having some kind of website terms of use on your own website as well.
Yeah, very much so. And this is what the website terms and conditions do. There will be in that document a clause around copyright and a clause around how people can and cannot use your website. And one of the sentences in there will say, you cannot steal the content, the pictures off my site and use them on your own website. So that's the flip side of the last question. So important that you have these documents there, because if they're not there, and Sheila, you know, that would be such good luck if they weren't there on the website you were looking for, because if they're not there, then, you know, you're allowed to use that information for yourself.
Really good tip. So I guess, yes, yeah, definitely the terms and conditions for any website's a no-brainer. Move on to Static's question, who's in the process of starting his own business, a classified website. Think of it like Gumtree, but for one specific item only. Very interesting. Now, let's say someone has posted an item on a website that charges a one-off payment to list, no commission. Would I be able to contact them legally to post their same product on my website because the initial website they had posted on already made their money and list the person's name and number publicly for people to contact? I'm assuming this comes under a similar kind of...
Yeah, it does. Unfortunately, Sadiq, I think it's going to be a similar answer to the previous question. I mean, well done for being so savvy and thinking about this. I think it's always good to kind of learn about these growth hacks. I actually listed my house on Airbnb the other night and got a phone call straight away from somebody wanting to rent my car spot. So I can see the idea that you've got behind this. However, it's going to be along the lines of the previous answer, which is you need to have a look at the terms and conditions. I fully see your reasoning there, that they've already made their money, and so why would they mind if you took that item and put it on your own website? However, the long-term effect, they might see that if you're constantly taking their items and putting them on your website's going to get better and better and more more traction and may compete with them in the future. So again, you need to check the website terms and conditions. You need to see whether they allow this type of thing, contacting the people that have posted on their website and reposting them on yours. Unfortunately, Sadiq, I think you might not like the answer you find. However, definitely worth looking.
Fantastic. Thanks for the question, Sadiq. We're moving now into the realm of contracts. And so the first question that we have comes from Sam. Sam's asking, how do you prepare for contract agreements? What are the basics that should be covered?
Sure. Good question, Sam. I think what I'll do is I'll make it into a two-stage answer. I'll talk about the basics of the contract, but then I'm going to give you the shortcut onto how to get these contracts created. So at a high level within law, to have a legally binding contract, There needs to be an agreement, consideration, mention, and certainty. So a written agreement with both parties signing it with some type of consideration. Often you hear people talk about offer acceptance consideration. However, Sam, I think definitely the shortcut to go here is if you are looking to create a contract, you need to start with some kind of template. So what people often do, and this is what lawyers do as well, we never draft documents from scratch. We never open up our Microsoft Word with a blank page and start drafting a contract. We always base it off something else. So what I would definitely suggest is you go out and you have a look at legal templates out there. You can jump on the LawPath website. We have over 200 legal templates. And then from there, you can draft a contract. So if it's a simple contract, you might not need to change the template too much. If it's more complex, you might need to amend it. One fantastic thing that LawPath has is we have software that helps you draft contracts. So our software actually asks you questions and then drafts the contract for you. Now, if that's not enough, we have our lawyer, our network of lawyers out there that can further modify the contract for you. But look, Sam, in terms of covering the basics, I definitely think that you should start with a template because that will already have all the basics in there. People have been drafting and improving and optimizing contracts for you know, years and years now. So don't reinvent the wheel. Go out there, find something that's super that's suitable, and then implement it specifically for yourself.
Great. Thank you so much for the question, Sam. Next question, a bit of a longer one here from Harold. Courts will not enforce contracts dealing with illegal and or unlawful acts, or contracts specifically created to hide or try to justify previous illegal unlawful acts if the reason for their existence is an attempt to legally bind the weaker party by the use of unconscionable conduct and duress forcing the other party into dealing from a position of weakness into signing a document they would normally entertain, especially a forbearance deed. Very long question, nice. Is this correct? Is this statement that Harold has put into his question around the forbearance deed and how courts will enforce contracts, is this actually accurate?
Yeah, Harold, very long answer, very short question. You are correct. Courts will not enforce an illegal contract or an illegal or unlawful act. So, I mean, they're not going to go any further than that. So your statement is correct.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, Harold. Okay, moving on to the next question, which comes from Tracy, again around contracts. In the recent legislation changes that affect standard form contracts, and this is something that I think just came in last month, Dom, is there anything else besides the unfair clause issues that has changed what we need to check our documentation for?
Sure, good question, Tracy, and very topical because, Tom, you are correct. In November, actually the 12th of November, new laws came in around unfair contract terms. In relation to standard form contracts. So for you, for those of you that are not aware, laws came in recently to do with small business contracts. So if you are a small business with under 20 employees, you are now protected with this new legislation. So just very quickly around what is a standard form, the courts haven't actually come up with a definition as yet. However, what it's looking like is the best way to explain it is it's a take it or a leave it contract. So often you have big companies that have a lot of power and they will write out a standard form contract and they'll say to all their suppliers or their contractors, here's the terms, you can't change them, take it or leave it. And so what this new legislation is trying to help is it's trying to stop this take it or leave it approach and say that the small businesses, they do have rights and they can go to court and have these rights enforced. So you might be asking, what kind of contracts will this cover? And it deals with all small business contracts that don't exceed $300 that were made after November 2016, so very, very recent. And again, they kind of include this concept or take it or leave it or agree to the contract or walk away. So in relation to more specifically your question, Tracy, it's only the unfair terms legislation that came in November. So that's all you need to have, all you need to look for in relation to standard form contracts. There is other legislation that is yet to be passed that was done earlier that you may have to check your documentation for, but in relation to the recent legislation, the one this month, it's only the unfair terms.
Fantastic, thanks for that, Dom. And just on that, to go a bit further, Tracy, for these all these questions, we will send out an email providing links to the relevant guides that Dom and the Law Bar team have put together on answering those questions. And I know for a fact that the standard form contracts and the legislation that's just come in last month is one that we've really looked at as well. Thanks for the question. Okay, Darren here has a question. Another one coming in from a plumbing business, Dom. Darren operates a small plumbing business in New South Wales and often has difficulty getting paid on time, sometimes at all. And as a lot of my work is domestic, he rarely has formal contracts in place, but generally an emailed confirmation or a verbal agreement from the people as well. We see a lot of this, don't we, Dom?
Yeah.
Pretty much every day. Is there anything specific I can put on my invoices or emails to ensure payment and that it's not their choice when or how much? I have already stated the tax invoice is a payment claim under the Building and Construction Industry Security of Payments Act. I would just like to know how I can show I am serious and require resolution immediately.
Sure. Look, I feel your pain, Darren. That is a real tough one when you do all this hard work and the client or the customer does not pay. But I think there is a pretty quick fix to this. It feels like it's been a bit of a theme today, and that is you must have a contract with the customer. So I know that sometimes it can be cumbersome to actually get them to sign something, and emails or verbal agreements over the phone are better, but you must have some kind of written agreement. Now, what we see a lot of our tradies do is they have a general agreement. It's usually only a one or two page agreement. On one side has the terms. It says, you know, this is the work I'm doing for you. This is the date that I need to be paid. This is how much you will be paid. But more importantly, it talks about penalties if they don't pay on time. If you have written payment terms down that say, you know, you must pay cash up front or 30-day terms or 60-day terms, and if you don't, then there is an interest rate applied or a penalty rate applied, it is very, very easy to go to the court and enforce that agreement because you have a document signed by both parties showing intention that they were entering into this agreement. However, if you just have a phone call or an email with vague details, it's going to be very hard to enforce. And even before you get to the point of actually going down to litigation, just having a one or a two page agreement that you can use with every customer doesn't have to be that complicated. What we see is they'll have the terms on the back, and on the front they'll just have handwritten customer's name, date of job, price of job. And so you can use the document every time you go and see a new customer. But really important you have this. The customer knows you're serious. You will feel like you've got a lot more security around the jobs that you're doing, and you'll know if you're not paid on time, then there'll be penalties put in place, and you'll be recouped that money.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, Tom, and thanks for the question, Darren. Okay, here comes a question from Alan. If you lend money to a private source without a formal agreement, only a rough contract drawn up by the other party, is it legal?
Alan, you know what? We get a lot of questions about this. Look, it is legal, but it might not be enforceable. So you can lend money to whoever you want, as long as there's no laws, or you know, you're not giving money to people, to the wrong parties. However, you can always lend money to whoever you want, but without an agreement it might not be enforceable. So you need a simple document drawn up that talks about, you know, that the fact that it is a loan. I mean, you need to make sure that people don't think it's a gift. You'll also need to put some kind of repayment date, maybe some kind of interest rate, and as we had with the previous question, maybe some kind of penalty rate if that loan is not paid by a certain time. So a very basic document will be sufficient. It will be legal, but you can Recapping on that, you can lend money to a private source without an agreement in place. However, it might not be enforceable.
Awesome. Thank you for the question, Alan. Here comes one. We've moved on now, Dom, into a few questions that we had come through around employment and human resources. So Colin has asked the question. Thanks for the question, Colin. How can we use your resources for the training of staff? As in-house counsel, I struggle to make legal issues relevant to staff in a meaningful way. Therefore, it is an uphill battle to achieve compliance. How can we help Colin there?
Hi, Colin. Well, look, yeah, I can imagine sometimes legal and accounting can be a little bit dry and it's hard to motivate staff. We have a huge, almost war chest of guides and blogs that we have here at LawPath, over 800 of them. And what we try and do as much as possible is make them as topical as possible. When we first started the business, we had lawyers writing our guides and our blogs, and they were fantastic from a legal perspective, but they were 5 or 6 pages long, and to be honest, no one outside of the legal teams wanted to read them. And maybe you can kind of sympathize there, Colin. But what we quickly learned was that legal can be synthesized into more simple concepts, and you can make it interesting to people. So we really took a lot of inspiration from a company that we work in the same building with, which is BuzzFeed. And a lot of you might know BuzzFeed. They always come out each day with the top 5 or top 10 or best 20 pitches. And it was really, really consumable content. And so what we did was we took a lot of legal issues and we nailed them right down to the simple areas what you needed to be aware of. Top 5 things you need to know about trademarks. 10 steps to firing a new employee. And that meant that the content was much more readable. And what we found was our blog gets, you know, tens of thousands of hits from clients and from new customers and from legal people every month. So I think one of the things that you could do is direct your staff towards our guides and our blogs, especially some of the more topical ones, especially around the kind of employment and HR issues, which can be very prevalent, especially towards the end of the year with Christmas parties and things like that. So making the information as easy to read as possible has really helped us and meant that we've become one of the leaders in legal information here in Australia for small and medium businesses. So definitely going through our guides and our blogs and our website and curating the ones that you think are appropriate for your staff and sending them out, you're more than welcome to do that.
Fantastic. Thanks for the question, Colin. From the other side of the perspective, I think chocolate and lollies always helps as well in that regard in making it easy to understand. Okay, we'll move on to the next question, which is around running a business, comes from Alexi. Question is, which ways exist to buy out companies' shares from shareholders who have disappeared? When are company shares issued to non-Australian residents? The way a proportion of issued shares of the person is 50%. Alternatively, what if it is less or more than 50%? How can other shareholders buy out shares from that person, Don?
Sure, Alexi, good question. This is one that comes up all the time. So I'm going to tell you how you can solve it, and then I'm going to tell you how you can avoid it in the future. So there are a number of ways that you can buy back shares from a shareholder that has left the company. The first would be a share buyback. So you can have an agreement in place with that person that allows the company to buy the shares back. The second is if you have a share sale, so you could sell that person, or that person could sell their shares to somebody else. Now, I'm going to read between the lines here and kind of guess that there may not be a good relationship anymore with that person. If you can't contact them anymore, how do you get those shares back? So, under the shareholders agreement or the constitution, there will be some terms in there around when a company can buy back those shares. So, for example, a lot of shareholders agreements allow a company to make a majority decision and buy back shares for the market price. So if you have a shareholders agreement, I would definitely go and look in that shareholders agreement to see if there are some clauses there that allow you to force the buyback. If you don't have a shareholders agreement, you are in a little bit of of trouble, and you may have to go and talk to a lawyer to come up with a unique and a custom plan on getting those shares back legally. So I think those are the three ways that you could do it if you are in a spot right now, Alexi, to stop this happening in the future. And this goes out to everyone else listening. When you start a company and you have shareholders and you are selling shares or issuing shares, it's really important to put in vesting conditions. What vesting conditions do is they say you are entitled, let's have an example, two shareholders start a business 50-50. They say you are entitled to 50% of the shares in the business, but it's over a 2-year period. What this stops is after a year, if that partner disappears, they're not entitled to the full amount of shares. They're only entitled to the amount that they've worked for. In this case, 2 years vesting would mean they would be entitled to 25% of the shares. So really important at the beginning that you put in these simple vesting conditions, and what that will do is it will stop people running away with shares in the company.
Fantastic. Just a quick one, Dom, on 50-50 allocations of business partners. We see a lot of this as well, where two people want to start a company, and they're usually friends at the time, and they often go into it and say, well, 50-50 is just going to be the way that we do it because there's two of us. How do you see that, I guess, working in the long term? Is that something that you would, you know, recommend overall? But you, I mean, you generally find that someone does a lot more work than someone else.
Yeah, sure. So, good question. I think, obviously, starting off, it's always a lot of people go in 50-50. This idea of vesting can change that if someone's working harder than the other. For example, you could say in your vesting schedule, which is usually created at the beginning of your company, you could say, whoever meets certain KPIs gets more shares. Whoever doesn't meet their KPIs gets less shares. So that's one way to keep it really even. The other issue we always see is if it's a 50-50 company, who makes the decision? If you guys are arguing, who makes the decision? That's why within a shareholders agreement, you usually have what's called a special majority decision for really important decisions being made by the company. And what this allows is that usually it's set at 75%, but it is totally up to you, which means for really important decisions, both people are going to have to agree. And if they don't agree, they're going to have to go to some kind of mediation.
Fantastic. Thanks, Dom. Hey, quick one on property. We'll run this one through quite quick because we're running a little bit low on time. But I have a client who wants to purchase property in Australia under a managed fund trust or proprietary limited company. Does he still need to have FIRB approval from Claudia?
No problem. Yeah, yes, the answer, the very, very short answer is yes. Doesn't matter if it's a company or it's a trust. For example, if it's a company and 20% of the ownership is an Australian, if not an Australian, FIRB approval is needed. If a trust, it comes down to the main beneficiaries of that trust. If they're not Australian, FIRB approval is needed. Just for you guys out there that don't know what FIRB is, Foreign Investment Review Board, if you're an international person coming in to the company to make an investment, you have to get that reviewed. Now, that is mostly happens here with properties. And so I suppose, Claudia, just before we finish, one exception there is that if it's a brand new property, there is an exemption to FIRB approval. So if your client is purchasing a property under a managed fund, a trust, or a company, and it's a new property, you might have an exception there. Very happy to chat in more detail around that with you.
Fantastic. Thank you for the question. Okay, moving into the realm of intellectual property, and we've actually had a question come through live that I think is going to be covered from this from Cheryl as well. But let's start off with a question from Jay. And Jay's asked, how do you trademark a domain name? Should I only trademark my logo?
Sure, good question, Jay, because I think a lot of people, they get a domain name and they think they own that name, but the reality is that they don't. They're actually just licensing that domain name off the registrar or the domain name registry, and they'll only get that for 2 years and then they have to give it back. So yes, you should register a domain name. You'll go through the normal process of a trademark registration, which is an application in a certain class. It then pens with the government for a certain amount of time, and then if approved, can be registered. The cost, actually there's just been a reduction in costs here in Australia. The cost is roughly about $700. That includes the government fees. So yes, you should register domain names. You should register them just like you would a normal trademark. If you're looking for more information there, Jay, we have tens or maybe hundreds of articles on our blog and our guides around trademark registration. Definitely recommend you jump in there.
Fantastic. Yeah, and I think from the other side of this as well, it's really important to make sure if you are registering a domain name to always check if there are going to be any conflicting trademarks. Run a search on Atmos. We'll provide the details on all of this at the end of the email. Okay, a question that's come through from Leslie. Patents and trademarks can be renewed before the due date, but what about innovation patents that have lasted for 8 years? Can they be extended like standard patents?
Good question, Leslie. The answer is no. So innovation patents were set up by the government for specifically 8 year periods. The lower threshold to get the innovation period meant that it was for 8 years and then they could not be renewed. So if you are looking to get an innovation patent, you need to be aware that it will be for 8 years and then it becomes public. But what you would need is maybe after that innovation patent to then apply for another patent, maybe a standard patent. But you would need to meet some new thresholds in getting that standard patent. The main one being that you would have to build on top of that innovation patent to get the standard patent.
Great. Thank you for the question, Leslie. I think we've got two or three more to go. Actually, that's it. Fantastic. we've got through all of them today. We might just leave it open for the next 5 to 10 minutes. If there are any questions that come through live on the call, we are moderating those questions. One thing that Cheryl touched on again, Dom, about intellectual property was around finding a worth for it. It is quite an expensive process, particularly as a new business. Is there any way that you could put a dollar value on
what intellectual property? Sure, actually valuing the intellectual property, yeah. Cheryl. That's a really good question. And you know what? We always ask this question, and there is not a simple answer. And the problem is that IP, by its very definition, is an intangible asset. And because it's an intangible asset, it is so hard to value. I mean, we often see startups kind of stick their finger in the wind and see what kind of valuation they get for their IP. I think one of the things you can do, I mean, there are some very complicated calculations that you can use. You can go to accountants and advisors and they can look to try and value your IP. I think what you would probably want to look at is the future value. So if you were to commercialize that IP, what would be the future value? Taking into consideration the fact that you may not be the sole person with that IP. So are you able to kind of forecast moving forward using that IP, you create a goods and service, and that goods and service generates X amount of revenue? You could potentially argue that that is the value of the IP. But look, it's a very good question, and it's one that really is very difficult to answer.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for asking the question too, Cheryl. We just wanted to touch, if you do have any questions, those who are on the webinar at the moment, you can put those in by clicking on the little chat icon that should be next to your username and sending that question through. We'll be looking at those for the next 10 minutes or so, and if you do have any additional questions that come up after that, we're always available on email. You can contact us at support@lordbath.com.au. But we wanted to provide the attendees of today's webinar with a really special offer coming up to the end of the year, and this is hopefully going to be the last legal expense that a lot of you will have for all of 2017. So the LawPath platform provides over 200 legal documents that you can go through. You can customize those documents specifically for your business, complete those out in a number of minutes, and then be able to use them as legally enforceable contracts through your business. So that 200 documents has a range of different categories that it covers, and it essentially can cover everything you need to start and run your business. Everything that we've touched on today, from starting out with, producing a shareholders agreement or a co-founder agreement, all the way through to managing your employees as well. So working through with your employment contracts, your contractor agreements, ensuring you've got non-disclosure agreements in place to protect confidentiality. And in addition to that, also all of the online documents that we talked about as well. You know, Dom discussed on the call that really every business is going to need, every website out there is going to need a terms and conditions of use and a privacy policy. You can get those on the Lawpath platform. And what we're doing for webinar attendees for today is we're actually taking $100 off the price of that. So what we usually charge an annual subscription on Lawpath for is $348. If you use the link below, which is try.lawpath.com.au/AMA, you'll be able to get that annual subscription, $100 off that, for $248. Now, this is an offer that ends in December, so it's one that you want to take up relatively quickly as well. Just adding in a few of the other additions, you'll be able to see all of the different benefits that the subscription provides you on the link as well. But some of the other things that we provide as part of that subscription is a discount on the legal quotes that you get as well. So if you need a contract that needs to be tailored specifically for your business, which is rather unique, or you need something done around, you know, trademark registrations and intellectual property that goes beyond what a legal contract can do, we can provide you with a discount on the services that you can get through Lawpath for those services as well as part of your annual subscription. So that's the link for it there, guys. We'll send that out as a as part of the email as well. Have we had any additional questions come through? Doesn't look like we have at this stage. If we do have any additional questions, we'll send out the email. Please feel free to reply to these as well. We'll keep a recording of this live for future use, so you can come back and listen to the answers that Dom's provided you with and have a look at the additional guides that we'll provide there as well. All right, if we don't have any questions, guys, I think we'll leave that as that for today. Thank you so much for all of you who have attended the webinars over the last 6 months as well. We've, you know, been really blown away with the responses that we've had. And, you know, we're really just here to help small businesses like you as well. So if you have any questions or if you have any suggestions for future webinar topics, it is something that we really want to double down with in 2017 as well. Be running a lot more with them in addition to running them with our partners in BizSpark today. And a big thanks to BizSpark as well for joining us for today and be able to facilitate the webinar. You know, Skype for Business has provided a really awesome avenue for being able to do these as well. So thanks so much, guys, and we'll be in touch shortly. Have a great Christmas.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Tom and the team.